When it comes to conducting, is there something about the nature of baton-wielding power that can lead to that power being distorted or taken advantage of? Is the age-old image of the autocratic Arturo Toscanini throwing scores at his musicians in a blind rage still the paradigm to which the industry aspires? And how can the orchestral sector today address its own leadership culture? Let's start with the broadest possible picture, what we as a society as a whole consider today to be good leadership. Avril Lehman is an executive coach and director of the Whitewater Group Consultancy.
Well, I think the fashion has changed apart from anything else, because traditionally it was quite an army standard to it, that it was a leader, they were born, not made, they had authority, they had status, they had power. And we've changed a lot, and we talk a lot about the balanced leader, because it's a mixture of intellectual and emotional and behavioural characteristics that make for the really good leader, not the sort of heroic leader, which you sometimes need in very challenging circumstances, but a lot of the time you need a lot of balance. I think the good leader is the one who realises you have to be professional about this, understanding the sort of science of people a little bit, what makes them tick, what's tricky about their jobs, really understanding theories of motivation, but they also have a capacity for some degree of empathy. They don't become so detached as a leader that they don't understand the impact that some of their actions will have. And then the behavioural, that you're absolutely dependable in that. And I think you use your power and status lightly.
Now, Avril Lehman works mostly in the business sector, but is that business model actually applicable to the creative arts and classical music?
It's a moot point as to whether or not leadership of culture is different from leadership of manufacturing or any other industry.
Hilary Carty is the director of the CLAW Leadership Programme, which has been training upcoming leaders in the cultural sector since 2004. So what does she think? Is it or should it be different?
It's a nuanced answer, unsurprisingly, because leadership is leadership. And actually what you're doing is you're galvanising, you're inspiring, you're encouraging, you're facilitating, you're making things happen. I think one of the things that we do deal differently from some other areas of society is in the area of risk. In many businesses, risk is something to be avoided. But in our world, it's at the core of what we do. Creative risk is what we're working with. We're trying to open things up. We're trying to see things differently. We're trying to rearrange something that's set into something that's possible. So we're working with creative risk at the heart.
Do behavioural issues come up in the training that you do? I mean, I'm imagining somebody might come on a CLAW leadership programme who is an orchestral manager, and that orchestral manager has to deal with recruiting conductors and also has to deal with their relationship with conductors. How much is that covered in what you teach? The actual kind of behavioural stuff of how you deal with somebody who is, for example, bullying in a rehearsal room?
We have to deal with that head on, because leadership is about engaging with people. So we do cover things like team dynamics. We do cover how to challenge, how to deal with disagreement. We have to encourage and facilitate our leaders to be able to speak truth to power. And we need to work with our leaders to have the courage to do that. When should you speak up? How might you speak up? What's the best way to tackle a difficult situation?
Hilary Carty. Now, I spoke to Nicholas Logie, who plays viola with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, and has also written a PhD on conducting and leadership, focusing in particular on young, aspiring conductors. The idea for his thesis came from him also having worked behind the scenes in orchestral management.
As part of that, I became very interested in the issues of management and noted that the metaphor of conductor and orchestra is used a lot in writers on management and leadership. What I wanted to look at was kind of turn it on its head and see what conductors could actually learn from established leadership theory.
So that metaphor that is used in the business world of the relationship between the orchestra and the conductor is presumably a paradigm to be aspired towards.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think it's used a lot by people like Roger Nierenberg and Ben Zander to motivate and excite leaders in the corporate world. But I think there are some major differences. One is the constraint of time and space. When a new CEO goes into a major job, they probably have a week or two to get to know the company, but a conductor is more or less parachuted into their leadership role. And the only comparison I could find was really with a supply teacher who would be parachuted into the classroom and has to just deal simply with the situation as it is. I mean, a conductor, if they're lucky, will have 2 days of rehearsal and they are in front of their workforce. The orchestra can see exactly what's going on. They really have to think on their feet.
I want to go back to something which you, in a way, start with when you're laying the groundwork of your PhD, which is to do with the history of conducting, really, and looking at particularly that image of the autocratic conductor, which kind of sprung up in the early mid-20th century, particularly thinking of somebody like Toscanini. Can you just kind of explain how it is that we got to the point where that was the view of what a conductor ought to look like and where we've moved since then?
Let's go back to the beginning of conducting. We're looking at around 1820. Louis Spohr maintains that he was the first musician to stand in front of an orchestra without an instrument. He waved a baton or a piece of roll of paper, I'm not quite sure which. They also think that maybe Carl Maria von Weber was the first silent conductor, so a music director that doesn't actually play an instrument. But the silent conductor really came in through complexity. The music was getting more complicated, specifically Beethoven symphonies. And one needed somebody to coordinate the ever-growing size of the orchestra. So for many decades, it was just an organizational issue. And then with Wagner and Berlioz and then von Bülow, one gets the what I call interpretive conductors, when they start actually imposing their own interpretation.
And that presumably gives a conductor an enormous degree of power, that they are the person with the score whose job it is to interpret it, which puts them in a position of incredible power over all the other musicians in the room.
Yes, exactly. But I think that's very much now a view of the mid 20th century. It's difficult to explain really why. I think the recording business had a lot to do with it and the way the conductor was promoted. But I think this is changing now.
Nicholas Logie. And that thought is echoed by Peter Stark, who started his professional life as a violinist, but is now a conductor himself and a leading teacher and trainer of conductors. You might have seen him as one of the coaches on the BBC television series Maestro a few years back.
When I started my profession as a violinist, one almost expected a conductor to be a bully. They were the autocrat, they were the dictator, and it went with the territory. It was fairly acceptable, if disliked, that a conductor could take charge to almost an extraordinary degree.
What are the kinds of behaviours we're talking about? Are they exclusively in the rehearsal room? Are they broader than that?
It goes outside the rehearsal room, but it starts in the rehearsal room. So a player who has an enormous job to do, very, very difficult job, and the focus, the spotlight is on that player, the conductor would possibly say, "Will you do that to me tonight?" Which puts the player under an absurd amount of pressure. I have seen players destroyed by conductors, but thankfully not in the last 10, 20 years. Nowadays, it is far, far more common for conductors to be enablers, to produce the right set of circumstances for players to be able to express their musical voice. And that really, for me, is the nub of the role of conductor. Orchestral musicians all have their own voice. It doesn't matter whether they are the most famous orchestras in the world or even amateur orchestras, youth orchestras, they all have an artistic voice, and they are actually desperate to have that voice heard.